Dear Rebecca Walkowitz, dear colleagues, dear students, ladies and gentlemen, it is with great pleasure that I welcome you to the 27 Wolfgang Ischer Lecture. As many of you know, this high-profile lecture series was inaugurated in 2009 by our colleague Alaid Aschmann, who's here today, jointly with Dr. Marshall Lepper from the Deutsche Literaturarchiv, who couldn't be here today. And it was intended, and still is intended, to commemorate the life and work of Professor Wolfgang Ischer, who had passed away 2 years prior to that, in 2007. I should like to take this opportunity to thank the Deutsche Literaturarchiv for its continuing support, and also to acknowledge even more gratefully the support of the Excellence Cluster, both in the aggregate, as it were, and as represented by Marion Vogtmann. Together with Karin Schunk, Frau Vogtmann has been invaluable and indeed indefatigable in organizing this year's events and in ironing out even the smallest administrative wrinkle. The annual Wolfgang Ischer Lecture is intended to showcase innovative approaches to literature from the perspectives of cultural studies, philosophy, or anthropology. Previous Ischer lecturers, including Jeff Hartman in 2009, or J. Hillis Miller in 2011, or Franco Moretti in 2015, either entered, or in many cases very interestingly re-entered, into a dialogue with Ischer's writings, or else opted for a critical engagement with some of the issues which were at the heart of Ischer's oeuvre. As will be seen presently, the latter is true for this year's Ischer lecture and Ischer lecturer, Professor Rebecca Walkowitz, whom I will now introduce to you. Rebecca Walkowitz is Professor of English in the English Department at Rutgers University, as well as an affiliate faculty member in the Rutgers Comparative Literature Program, which already sort of indicates some of her scale or range. She received her education at Harvard-Radcliffe, at the University of Sussex, and again at Harvard, and prior to joining Rutgers, taught at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Throughout her distinguished career so far, Professor Walkowitz has been the recipient of numerous prestigious awards, not least for two of her books. She has also served as editor of book series and journals, including for the book series Literature Now and for the journals Contemporary Literature, and she was president of the Modernist Studies Association, to name only a very few of her many activities. In what follows, I shall very briefly focus on those two of her books, which on the one hand link her work back to Wolfgang Ischer's, and which, on the other hand, indicate new directions which we ourselves, you know, as department and as university, might take in the future. Thus, Rebecca Walkowitz's first book, Cosmopolitan Style, Modernism Beyond the Nation of 2006, can, I think, usefully be read in conjunction with Ischer's early essays, which, according to Ben de Bruyn, author of the 2012 volume Ischer, A Companion, may be seen as an attempt to unearth the historical roots of modernism. Yet, at the same time, Rebecca Walkowitz in Cosmopolitan Style argues that early modernist writers such as Conrad Wolf or Joyce need to be understood alongside late 20th century transnational authors, for instance, Max Sebald, as new theories of cosmopolitanism are crucially shaped by the history of early modernism. The second book, which I believe is crucial to our own current preoccupation with various forms of migration of people, ideas, texts, is Born Translated, the contemporary novel in an age of world literature, which was published in 2015. In it, Rebecca Walkowitz constructs a framework for understanding the effects of translation on late 20th and early 21st fiction, but also on digital art, avant-garde magazines, and literary anthologies. And, you know, if I may add a more personal comment here, this framework has already proved incredibly inspiring and productive to our MA students, who over the course of the semester have applied this framework to a wide variety of literary texts and genres, ranging from medieval epic poetry to the contemporary German-Swiss novel Der Goli bin ich. Born Translated also recasts literary history as a series of convergences and departures, and thus redefines conceptions of author, reader, and nation. It is from this context, and I think from the context of Born Translated, that Rebecca Walkowitz's Easel Lecture Today has emerged, reading both literary history and the monolingual model. Please welcome Rebecca Walkowitz.
Well, first of all, many thanks for that very generous introduction. Es ist mir eine große Ehre, heute Abend hier bei Ihnen zu sein. I'm grateful for the intellectual hospitality shown to me by the staff of the University of Konstanz, and I'm especially grateful to Professor Dr. Sylvia Mergenthal for her invitation and very warm welcome. Ich möchte mich dafür entschuldigen, dass ich Ihre Gastfreundschaft nicht damit honorieren kann, auf Deutsch zu sprechen. I'm mindful and deeply appreciative of the civic hospitality expressed by the present government of Germany toward its European neighbors and also towards neighbors well beyond Europe. I'm also mindful and deeply appreciative that our conversations today are made possible by a fundamental commitment to integration and international exchange, which has been part of Professor Eichester's legacy, both as a founder of this university and as a scholar of comparative literature and literary theory. My remarks today are inspired by two of Professor Eichester's core arguments about the humanities, which he outlined in an essay published towards the end of his life in 2004 on the occasion of the 25th anniversary of the US journal New Literary History. The first argument is a claim about the importance of engaging with languages in the context of other languages, in particular, the importance of breaking down national boundaries in scholarship and in theoretical approaches to literature. In his essay, Eichester exhorts us to talk with each other across languages, to be aware of which languages have been part of the conversation and which have not, and also to encourage and reflect on the practice of translation, including the translation of literary criticism. Eichester's second argument is a claim about the importance of reevaluating the concept of literary history, which he contends, and these are his words, can no longer be conceived in terms of a linear arrangement of literary works that keep influencing one another and seem to be on the way to an as yet undisclosed telos. Thinking about linearity, he rejects national as well as linguistic exclusivity. And thinking about telos, he breaks with the assumption that readers encounter books as a single series in which each unit represents a gross accumulation of knowledge and literary merit. These two arguments are related, of course, since reflecting on languages and on the history of languages is likely to interfere with linear and teleological concepts of literary production. Sometimes we forget that what seems to be bounded within one nation is in fact made possible by histories of cooperation, exchange, and movement among many nations. National histories are comparative histories. As we say in the language of New York City, somos todos migrantes. 100 years ago, the people of Denmark hosted my great-grandparents and their young family as they fled Poland and waded through the First World War to join their extended family in the United States. My grandfather was born in Denmark. When he was 5, he and his parents were able to arrange passage on the Helig Olaf, a Scandinavian-operated ship built in Glasgow by Alexander Stephen and Sons. That Danish-Scottish ship brought 5-year-old Saul and his family from Copenhagen to Ellis Island, where they were admitted and the family settled. I and many other Americans have been nourished by the economic and political cooperation of European nations. My postgraduate career was launched by 2 years of study as a Marshall Scholar in the critical theory program at the University of Sussex in the early 1990s. In 1953, as some of you may know, British Parliament established the Marshall Scholarship as a living gift to the United States in recognition of the economic aid provided to the United Kingdom, France, Germany, and other nations in the wake of the Second World War. 70 years ago last month, U.S. Secretary of State George C. Marshall initiated what would be called the Marshall Plan during a brief speech delivered at Harvard University's commencement exercises. Marshall's insistence on a large-scale, coordinated economic relief plan for Europe was recognized on both sides of the Atlantic as an historic opportunity for multilateral cooperation. Just a few weeks ago, scholars and government ministers gathered at Harvard to consider the legacy of the Marshall Experiment in the context of rising isolationism, including the isolationism advocated by the present U.S. government. These conversations about personal and political history are crucial to our conversations about literary history, since recognizing the collaborative origins of our present moment, including this moment, now, here, is necessary to the prospect and vision of any collaboration to come. At the turn of the last century, Linda Hutchin, who is a prior ESER lecturer and at the time was president of the Modern Language Association, she sounded a call to rethink the national model of literary history. In the opening essay of a volume featuring her contribution and several responses, Hutchin observed that the fiction of cultural purity persists, and she located that fiction not only in the eruptions of sectarian violence she saw in nations around the world, but also in the patterns of intellectual labor that organize knowledge and institutions such as the university. The problem with the national model, she argued, was twofold. Its erasure of competing languages and ethnicities within literary cultures, and the related implication that languages and cultures move forward, alone and unchanging, from one historical period to the next. In the past two decades, the national model has ceased to operate as the only or necessary container for literary history. It now competes with many other political and topographic containers, as well as with various language containers. Scholars who organize themselves around global languages, such as English, Spanish, French, and Chinese, can attest to the tensions and overlaps between national and linguistic classifications, whether French and Francophone, Spanish and Catalan, Chinese and Sinophone. The linguistic model, it turns out, is no more coherent than the national one, and indeed reinforces some of the same fictions of homogeneous community, intrinsic belonging, and uncontaminated progress over time. My lecture today focuses on works of Anglophone fiction that operate in tension with various expressions of multilingualism, or what the Francophone scholar Yasser El-Hariri has called infralingualism. In the works I'll be discussing, we see English in the state of becoming and having been something else. These are not simply novels in one language with a sprinkling of other languages placed within them, or even novels that seek to operate in a minor, rotten, or hyper-localized register of English. Instead, they are works that seek to be English and not English, native and foreign at the same time. Today's Anglophone fiction thus includes what I call post-Anglophone fiction. These works are post-monolingual in the sense described by Yasmin Yildiz in her important book, Beyond the Mother Tongue. You don't have to be an English writer to write in English. We've known that for some time. But you don't even have to write in English to write in English, as the novelists Juno Diaz and Paul Kingsnorth have recently shown us. Post-Anglophone writing heralds a transition from the unremarked dominance of English language works produced in the US and the UK to the analysis of the multilingual histories of those works and the relationship of those works to literatures and languages beyond English. The post in post-Anglophone registers histories of language contact and amalgamation. It registers a shift away from the opposition between Anglo-American literature and world literatures in English, and a new emphasis on the uneven mechanisms of transmission and communication, such as access to literacy, orthographic conventions, and the formatting of printed books. Novelists are challenging the homogenization of English at any scale. We no longer agree what the term Anglophone means and what it needs to mean going forward. The post-Anglophone is not simply a shift in nomenclature. It is a shift in our understanding of what language does. Rather than a conduit for individual or collective individual expression, say the collective individual of a nation, language appears as a technology of adding, breaking, and establishing collectives of various kinds. Scholars of linguistics have known this for some time, but it bears repeating. A language is not an empirical reality. It is an historical norm. As a concept, post-Anglophone does not distinguish between native and non-native access to English, and between works produced by writers operating in their first language and works produced by writers operating in second or multiple languages. If English literary history has emphasized monolingual trajectories, the ways that English language works follow and predict other English language works, post-Anglophone histories will need to develop and draw out alternative paths. The remainder of my remarks today will consist of three unequal parts. First, I'll consider the comparative history of the Anglophone as a category of reading and organizing literature. Second, I'll consider how contemporary novelists have reflected on the production and representation of Anglophone literature, and I'll look at some prominent examples from the past few years. And finally, I'll speculate about what I think we can gain by rethinking literary history from the perspective of embodied languages. Part one, Anglophone reading, or how English became one. As a qualifier of literature, Anglophone has two principal meanings. These meanings have developed diachronically, but they operate more or less synchronically today. First, Anglophone literature was the alternative to British and American literature in English. Everything that wasn't British and American literature was Anglophone literature, which is now often called global Anglophone literature or world Anglophone literature, though still meaning literature of the so-called peripheries, not the metropolitan English language literature of London and New York. Some of this global Anglophone literature has been published in London and New York, but we generally mean that its authors were born outside of Britain and the United States. The works are Anglophone less because of language than because of authorship. Their authors are not metropolitan or have not always been metropolitan. Conversely, British and American writers may write in English, but they are not Anglophone writers. The second meaning of Anglophone refers only to the language of the original work. Any English language novel is an Anglophone novel. The increasing dominance of this meaning can be observed institutionally in academic job advertisements, book reviews, and the reorganization of the Man Booker Prize in the UK. Recent job searches at Harvard University, to take one example, make use of the exclusive and the inclusive meanings at the same time. The English department sought a specialist in post-1945 British literature who is also a specialist in what the advertisement called diasporic Anglophone literatures, so first meaning. Meanwhile, they ran a second search in a field called Anglophone modernism, so second meaning. When I applied for jobs in 1999, there was British modernism, American modernism, and occasionally transatlantic modernism. That was the vanguard, though it didn't include many parts of the Atlantic. At a campus visit for a job in British modernism, a scholar of the novel in India, Riley, remarked that there were really very few British modernists when you came to think of it. I think she was pointing out that the British modernists I was talking about, Joseph Conrad and James Joyce, hadn't started their lives in London and weren't in any straightforward way British at all. As a classification, Anglophone modernism consigns birthplace, citizenship, and residency to the background while foregrounding medium. It opens the door to any work in English, no matter where it began or who wrote it. I suspect that the new classification is not meant to evacuate place so much as to remediate the exclusive and unspoken focus on only some places. Anglophone modernism might thus encourage projects that consider the literary production of colonial writers and the networks of exchange that generated Anglophone modernism in and from other languages. The turn from nation to medium implies histories of print culture, circulation, and translation. These methodologies allow us to track versions of Anglophone modernism that aren't or aren't immediately Anglophone. They also allow us to consider surprising vectors of cause and effect. I would include here Peter Callany's account in a book called The Commonwealth of Letters of how writers from the Caribbean contributed to the prestige of metropolitan literature in London and how the institutional emergence of global English fiction was nurtured by the intellectual collaborations and support of post-colonial novelists. The Anglophone becomes an occasion to think about the interactions among regional literary cultures. No longer marking the separation of metropole and periphery, the Anglophone in this usage helps us to see the importance of transnational networks and the dynamic relationship among what appear to be distinct coteries. And yet, sometimes it can seem like a quick step from the transnational Anglophone to the global Anglophone, in which struggles over center and periphery, national and colonial, are replaced by an undifferentiated, world-sized English. I found it helpful to consider this dynamic historically and comparatively by looking to Sinophone and Francophone studies, whose scholars have been thinking for some time about how to keep linguistic expansion from becoming a new kind of linguistic nationalism. While scholars of literature in English have been enlarging the Anglophone, scholars of literature in French have expressed concerns about recent proposals for a world-sized approach. In 2007, a group of writers published a manifesto in Le Monde in which they called for dissolving the category of Francophone literature and adopting instead the category of world literature in French. Rejecting a long academic tradition of distinguishing between French writing by citizens of France and secondary, derogated Francophone writing by everyone else, the manifesto insists on a single category that would recognize and celebrate the diversity of literary production in French to core. Critics of the manifesto have argued that abandoning the Francophone category risks the loss of hard-won ground. Some have seen the expansion of French writing as a renewal of French nationalism on a global scale. Charles Forstick has objected to the embrace of monolingualism at any scale. He argues, and these are his words, "To uncouple literature from the unit of the nation is to stop short. A post-colonial critique of Littérature Monde potentially suggests further uncoupling of literature from its association with the unit of a single language." For Forstick, the problem is not, or not only, that migrant writers don't have equal access to French writing and are thus excluded from political and cultural forms of citizenship. The problem is that political and cultural forms of citizenship depend too much on the affirmation of French. And here, Forstick is echoed by translation theorists and activists in languages well beyond French, such as Jennifer Scapatone, who has insisted, at this historical moment, challenging the very understanding of national languages is crucial for the fight against xenophobia and racism. The Sinophone offers an intriguing comparison. Like the first Anglophone model, it was imagined as a designation for Sinitic writing produced by authors located outside China. Unlike that Anglophone model, the Sinophone also included multilingual writing produced inside China, though not Chinese writing produced inside China. According to Xu Meishi, who coined the term, Sinophone literature is distinguished principally by its inclusion of multiple idiolects and its incorporation of several languages. The category holds together an enormous range of sounds and orthographies, whereas Chinese designates a nationalist paradigm that insists on homogeneous usage and consistency over time. As Xu points out, Chinese should be the designation of a nationality, such that Chinese languages would be any language used in China. Instead, there is only one tongue that gets to count as Chinese, which crowds out rival languages and versions of language. Studies of literature in English can benefit from what Sinophone studies knows about the decoupling of language and territory, and from what Francophone studies knows about the nationalist implications of globalist paradigms. Extending English to the rest of the world, for example, can be a way of insisting on English at home. In our institutions, as well as in our scholarship, we need to find ways to work collaboratively so our literary histories are less constrained by the currency of isolated languages. In an article published last year in the Times Higher Education Supplement, Charles Burdett argued that specialists working in discrete fields associated with nation states need to shift their expertise so that they are studying the interactions among cultures. A professor of Italian at the University of Bristol in the UK and a member of the Transnationalizing Modern Languages Project, Burdett argues that knowing and engaging with multiple languages must be the starting point for reshaping the humanities and social science disciplines. The aim of this project is not to overcome national languages and their impetus to language acquisition. Far from it. The project aims instead to place multilingualism and the history of languages at the center of the global university. Thinking about literature from these perspectives, we might ask ourselves somewhat more forcefully about the comparative origins of Anglophone writing, about its circulation today into and out of many other languages, and about its uses in the historical production of political and social collectivities. Amir Mufti has argued that the idea of languages as coherent, distinct wholes is an inheritance of colonialism. If we wish to move beyond that inheritance, we will have to learn to count English differently. How do we do that? Part two, post-Anglophone writing, or how English becomes both. Literary history is a story of wakes, not breaks. The category of Anglophone literature is with us, but we are starting to see its past as well as its possible futures. In the literature of the present, there is a new wariness about the deployment of English as an original language and an effort to represent the relationship between English and other languages on the page. One version of this wariness is visible in the work of Dominican-American writer Junot Diaz, whose strategic use of orthography dramatizes the overlapping history of books and languages. Diaz knows that books are not simply containers for languages. They also establish the location of languages. They do this, for example, by reproducing the national lexicon while marking out and distinguishing, through italics, words that are foreign or outside that lexicon. In English, literary fiction since the 19th century has used italics to affirm the borders between local and global diction. Diaz invokes this convention and breaks it in his 2012 collection of short stories, This Is How You Lose Her. Within this work, some Spanish words appear in italics, while others appear just like the English words or as English words in Roman font. In Diaz's stories, we are presented with words that are local and foreign at the same time. There is a standard idiolect and a demotic, but both involve Spanish. Standard English is not even on the table. Diaz asks us to consider what the languages of U.S. fiction have been and what they might be going forward. And I just want to note for you here, I realize it's a little bit bleached out, but what I've done is I've underlined for you the non-italicized words that to most English language readers would be understood as Spanish words. So even the first word, pura mierda, guapizima, andiacita, campesina. And then I arrow here is meant just to show you the two words that have been italicized, partly to mark out that for the Dominican American narrator, the woman that he's talking about, as he says on the facing page I haven't showed you, he says he's Dominican American, but she's Dominican. And for that reason, she's using a kind of a version of Spanish that can't count as part of the native language of the text. Languages are not only a medium, they are a principal theme in Diaz's work. When the work travels into other languages, translators have to figure out how to register the formal and visual dimensions of that theme. The way words appear on the page, the selective use of italics, the way that some Spanish words function locally while others do not, the historical and political resonance of encountering U.S. fiction in at least two local languages, of insisting that there are two or more rather than only one. It's not hard to see how Diaz's writing might be post-Anglophone. He shows that English is made up of languages beyond English, and he shows that the language of his fiction has been shaped in part by the historical phenomenon of the book. Yoking the expressivity of contemporary fiction to the history of print, Diaz is establishing a realism of languages. He shows us where languages come from, what systems and institutions have made them possible or have blocked their emergence, and how they are embedded and embodied in the world. Because his stories withhold italics, they break with the norms of Anglophone publishing. But it turns out that it is not simply a matter of ignoring these norms or rejecting them outright. Far from eradicating the typographic distinction between local and foreign words, Diaz has made this distinction function regionally. Moreover, typographic foreignness has helped to generate the work in the first place. In his brain, he explains in an interview, English and Spanish are in italics. My guess is that some of you are familiar with Diaz's stories and novels, but I'd now like to turn to an example of typographic multilingualism that may be less familiar to you, Paul Kingsnorth's The Wake, which was longlisted for the 2014 Mon Booker Prize. Written in a kind of modernized Anglo-Saxon or Anglo-Saxonized English, The Wake tells the story of the Norman conquest from the perspective of the conquered. In order to remind us that we were reading from an unassimilated point of view, That is, from the point of view of an Anglo-Saxon who has refused to incorporate French, King's North has restricted himself, wherever possible, to the words, sounds, punctuation, and orthography of pre-conquest England. So I don't know if you can see it from the back, but it's all lowercase. It is mostly he's tried to remove or leave out certain kinds of Latinate contemporary English words. The spelling has a kind of Anglo-Saxon sort of feel to it. It takes a while to get used to reading it, but this is actually a contemporary novel. Like Diaz, King's North goes further than this, however, for what we encounter on the page of the printed book is not simply a pseudo-language intended to convey the feeling of the old language, as King's North puts it, but the visual display of that language in some approximate mimesis of his historical emergence as literature. The novel presents us with Anglo-Saxon vocabulary and also the lowercase letters and minimal punctuation that were used in medieval manuscripts 400 years before the appearance of print. In a note on language placed at the end of the book, King's North explains that he has sought to produce a shadow tongue in which Anglo-Saxon could be apprehended beneath or within the experience of modern English. The linguistic experience is something between a new combined language, something like Nadsat in Anthony Burgess's A Clockwork Orange, and an English in the process of becoming or trying not to become modern. The typefaces, explained in yet another note, offer the most striking visual representation of the transition from Anglo-Saxon to Anglophone. For the titling, the novel uses Gothic blackletter font, modeled on the style of 15th century handwriting. But most of the text appears in a version of Jensen, a Roman letter typeface invented for the printed book by Gutenberg disciple Nicholas Jensen. Incorporating medieval and modern, King's North suggests that the normative technologies of the novel, the standardization of typeface and format, orthography and font, are complicit in the invisibility of English. We have forgotten the history of English. We have forgotten that English has a history. The Wake hopes to awaken our memory. In King's North's novel, the flourishing of the English language, represented by the triumph of contemporary Anglophone fiction, is rooted in the physical brutality of the conquest. The novel presents that history at the level of text and paratext, while also seeking to inaugurate an alternative localist future. It associates that future with the return to small-scale book production and the turn away from large-scale financing. The Wake is thus not only post-Anglophone, it is also post-press, a term coined by Nick LaVey to describe contemporary literature that is created outside of the established circles of book production. The novel was first manufactured by the crowdsourced publisher Unbound, and UK editions list early supporters in the back pages of the printed book. Versa Press, an independent printer based in East Peoria, Illinois, manufactured the US edition. Eschewing the globalization of bookmaking and book marketing, King's North's novel thus reminds us that history and politics of languages are embedded in the history and politics of print. For one thing, corporate publishers are unlikely to support the typographic and orthographic experimentalism of an unproven novelist. But King's North is also keen to suggest that the function of literary works depends in part on the collectives that make, underwrite, and read them. By generating new literary collectives, he hopes to alter the political register and scale of Anglophone fiction. The relationship between the history of language and the history of print thus operates beyond the page, and it also operates on the page, impeding the expressive dimension of language. The novel's pre-modern orthography reminds us that English is an aggregation of languages and language uses. Every fluent reader of English is a foreign reader of this text. The novel's visual heteroglossia, its layering of language histories, exists in tension with verbal claims for an unmixed pre-conquest idiom. It is also very much a novel of the present. This Wake remediates the visual culture of digital media by emphasizing the materiality of languages in print. In the time that remains, I'd like to turn to a second novel from the 2014 Booker long list, Ali Smith's How to Be Both, which features yet another kind of shadow tongue. Like King's North, Smith asks us to consider the words, voices, bodies, and agents that precede or lay beneath the book we hold in our hands. How to Be Both evokes multiple languages and histories of language, by generating the impression of several narratives, objects, genre, history, historical periods, and media. We are presented with memories and adaptations rather than primary expressions of thought, voice, or experience. Time is often out of joint, and so are words. The pages feature muddied translations or unverified reportage without any recourse to correction or clarification. Smith's novel emphasizes not only the history of writing, but also, like our other examples, the typographic representation of that writing. The characters make free use of smartphones and iPads and other digital technologies, but the work relies on the codex and on the reader's visual experience of letters and shapes on the page. The work is thus post-digital or bookish in the sense used by Jessica Pressman. It reaffirms the technologies of the book while benefiting through composition, format, design, and circulation from the technologies of the computer. Insisting on the book becomes a way to make the reader encounter the text as an object, but it is also a way to make the reader into an operator of that object. The narrative signals this process when it tells us that one of the main characters, George, rewatches the same iPad video over and over again. She does this, she says, because she wants to witness the happening, by which she means the fact of circulation rather than the represented acts. We too are asked to witness the happening, the way the book presents itself to us, the way its words and ideas physically and figuratively twist into other words, and our experiences as readers and handlers. Experiences of reading, handling, researching, and watching are central to the novel's plot. How to be both fold circulation into production most explicitly by drawing our attention to the book's two parts. One part is presented in the first person by the ghost of a 15th century Italian painter known as Francesco, and the other is presented in the third person but related through the perspective of a 21st century teenager known as George. Both parts are titled One on the pages that precede each section. Instead of enumerating first part and second part, the titles seem instead to function as echoes or halves. The book's parts consist of stories that are one, but not the only one. They are one, but made up of other, no longer visible ones. Each part is less uniform, less distinct, and less original than the designation one usually implies. This play on the distinctiveness and chronology of parts is important to our understanding about the distinctiveness and chronology of the novel's characters. While it may first appear that the novel has given us a story about a person in the far past and a story about a person now, it turns out that each story is both ghostly and prescient in its own way, with traces of the other story appearing both before and also after the story we are reading. The novel offers a variety of ways of conceiving of this kind of ghosting, which is both foreshadowing and backshadowing, intimation of what is to come and of what has already been. Themes and forms of ghostliness prepare us to notice ghostliness at the level of language. We can observe all of the names that are intimated but never cited or revealed in the text. Those include the name of the painter narrator, born a girl, who chooses the name Francesco so that she, now he, can have a career as an artist. Francesco chooses a boy's name that reminds him of his mother's French-sounding name, but the originals, his name and hers, remain unspoken. Relating a plan for a painting, the painter-narrator relates the plan of the narrative to tell a story, but tell it more than one way at once, and tell another underneath it, uprising through the skin of it. These words are placed on the page with visual breaks, enjambments, and you can see it here right about 7, 8, 9 lines down. These words are placed on the page with visual breaks and enjambments so that we experience more than one meaning of the word one. We also experience more than one genre. Are we reading poetry or prose? The unmentioned names of the story point to differences of gender and language, as do many other references to unrepresented words that the narrator doesn't know and doesn't repeat, or represented words that are, he explains, not the right word. These not right words include an extended passage in English based on a passage that has been rendered from Italian by Google Translate. We see only the Google Translate version. The original Italian and the corrected English are never given. And just to read this out to you, it says, He reads something out. H reads something out. Casso was the victim of the plague that Enfierti in Bologna between 1477 and 1478. The 78 would be the most likely date. Jackets in this year's disease came of rawness. The few early works do not leave, almost predict, doing composition so innovative, imaginative, and it goes on like that. Meanwhile, contemporary slang is dropped into the 15th century narrative, while in the contemporary narrative, George, also born a girl, persistently corrects her mother's grammar and declares her preference for scholarly terms such as impervious and alacrity. The narrative we are reading is made up of words that have been chosen for and often placed on the page. And though both sections arrive in the present tense, as if happening as we hold the book, we have the keen sense that they may have been written, hailed into existence by the characters themselves. At the end of the George section, she seems to be waiting, both for other characters to act and for the narrative to continue. This is one of the novel's many images of twist, in which the story and its container briefly overlap. There is the cross-cutting of narrative and book, and there is also famously more than one book, even in English and even in what appears to be one edition. And I don't know if you can see here, but these are both editions that I own. The page on the left comes from page 3 of one of the editions that I own, and the page on the right comes from page 161. Across the US and UK imprints, and I have to say I tried to go see, it's translated as By Design here, and I haven't seen whether the editions work the same way here. It wasn't in the bookstore. Across the US and UK imprints, Smith's novel has been released in two different versions. Some copies begin with George's section and some with Francesco's. From the get-go, book and narrative are always both. Two books, two narratives, book and narrative intertwined rather than only one. The book's contribution to the novel's bothness is emphasized in various ways. We see twists on the page, two-dimensional drawings, unjustified lines, and unusual capitalization and orthography. We are told at one point, in a comment attributed to the Italian humanist Leon Battista Alberti, that beauty in its most completeness is never found in a single body, but is something shared instead between more than one body. This comment is presented as a truth about the power of representation to give substance and quality to its object, but it is also a truth about audiences, whose active reception of the work is part of its ongoing production. We have to manipulate the book and possibly purchase more than one book in order to read the whole novel. But of course, this process makes it impossible to conceive of only one novel, or of a novel that can be read only one time. How to Be Both imagines literary history as a twisting together of many versions of the work and many histories of language rather than a single monolingual progression. It uses the visual representation of language to disrupt both the monolingualism of the historical novel and the interlingualism of the translated book. Oriented towards the past as well as the future, Smith's Anglophone novel is divided and layered by its relationship with other languages, formats, and media. She is interested in the embodiment of literature and also in the bodies that make literature. She brings these two realisms together, dramatizing the histories of gender and sexuality that shape what we know about the production and circulation of artworks. Part 3, Embodied Languages Now. By emphasizing literature's ghostliness, its traces of prior agents and prior languages, Smith places her work in the world. In this sense, we can see how Diaz's, Kingsnorth's, and Smith's writing fits with Frederick Jameson's recent claim that the thematics of transmission and technology are crucial to the political dimensions of contemporary fiction. Jameson distinguishes a new focus on the materiality of communication systems from the complacent writing about writing that he associates with the postmodern novel. He's thinking of works such as David Mitchell's Cloud Atlas, in which the drama of circulating books serves as an implicit rebuttal to the frictionless logic of globalization. In the novels I've been discussing, the thematics of transmission and technology point to the friction that operates within what appears to be a single language. By asking us to witness artworks in the process of becoming, contemporary writers suggest that literary histories will need to be understood comparatively. We will need to read from the perspective of the future as well as the past, understanding that literary works operate within and help to generate an aggregation of languages communities and audiences. Reading from the perspective of world literature, we have to encounter and acknowledge that aggregation, even at the scale of home. Approaching contemporary literature through comparative literature, I've argued that we need to shift from the study of works belonging to languages to the study of works that are written in languages. No longer possessed by a language, literary works could then be analyzed for the ways they enter and use languages and for the ways they depart and reject them. This shift, I've conjectured, would allow us to pay greater attention to the histories and futures of translation, to the internal diversity of English as a language of various locations and proficiencies, and to the pathways and blockages that shape what can be written and what can be read. Post-Anglophone fiction asks us to consider the misfit between contemporary literature and the philological categories that have organized intellectual work. Disabling philological categories, we'll have to organize intellectual work differently. The framework of literatures in languages is a first step, since it allows us to emphasize kinds of books rather than kinds of writers. But it can't be the only step, since we will need to ask how works participate in literary cultures that are both smaller and larger than the nation, organized around more and less than a single tongue. Thinking about how literary histories converge and depart, we will need to integrate histories of media, translation practice, and reception. We will need to think about the size and quantity of the literary object, and how it belongs and where. Literary history can't be all in one language. We've heard that by now. But language can't be all in one language either. The monolingual unit has constrained our approach to literary histories of the past. We have the opportunity to consider what literary histories should look like in the future. We can begin by asking how contemporary novels, concerned more than ever with the proliferation of formats, media, and audiences, are approaching that horizon. Thank you.
For me, I mean, the experience of reading both also as in your presentation, the connection between looking at sort of minute details of a text and material details of the text, and then opening up this very sort of vast scale of sort of political, historical, cultural, institutional aspects of reading and literature. So that's great.
Thank you.
Rebecca's kindly promised to ask questions of anybody who wants to.
Questions, comments, accusations. Yes.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for this inspiring lecture. I think Wolfgang Ieser would have liked it because one of his favorite
What's
texts.
What's your pat on the shoulder?
His favorite text is The Oxen of the Sun.
Yeah.
Chapter in Ulysses, and that is going almost as far as you were going with these examples that you showed us.
Yeah.
In this case, it's not about multilingualism, but it is the clash or collision of styles.
Yes.
And so I think there is a kind of interesting connection between his predilections and intellection. And I'm also happy that Heike Schiffer is right next to me because she has introduced me to exactly that postmodern turn in making the book not only medium, metaphor, and object that we gaze at anew as though we had never known what a book is.
Yeah.
So, like coming back, the zigzag version of topography,
which
is almost a reminder of what the oxen, coming back to the oxen, did, you know, in the furrows, going back and forth, because it's a very archaic form of writing, actually, this continuity. But my question is now that we are faced with these very interesting stimuli, you know, what about comprehension? What really makes sense to me is that today we live in a world where we can no longer rely on comprehension in a very straightforward way.
Mm-hmm.
When we go in on a bus, for instance, we can no longer on a trip, we can no longer rely that we overhear and understand what the people around us are saying. This is a new situation, and it's a new normal. Situation. So why go to books, open the pages, and expect that you would have a thorough understanding of the text? Maybe that is also a very old-fashioned concept, but then our own language also always uses the word understand. We have to better understand.
Yeah.
So what about our gesture. Maybe we should relax, sit back, and just let this pass and enjoy the multiplicity and no longer focus in a linear way on what we are not understanding.
Thank you. Well, I guess I would say that a turn towards an integrationist or multicultural relationship to national culture and to the literary cultures that are produced within a geography, a territory, does require us to rethink the standard of comprehension and the uniformity of comprehension historically as well as in the present. That is, it seems to me that we're now more aware than ever of the many languages that are spoken within what have been understood as national languages, not only languages that come in through migration, but the many different versions of language that exist and have existed within places like, obviously, like Switzerland, Spain, Italy. If I imagine some of you have read My Brilliant Friend, Elena Ferrante's novel. Yes? Yeah? No? Okay. Well, My Brilliant Friend, I don't know what it's translated as here, has been an extremely popular and very influential book translated from, a contemporary novel translated from Italian into English. It's one of the most highly selling current contemporary works in translation in the United States right now, and it has burgeoned a kind of renewed interest in other Italian books that are much less well known.
It's taken slightly longer to hit Germany.
Yeah. It's an interesting phenomenon, but one of the things that...
I think the first volume has been translated by now, but I don't know about the others.
About the others. There's four volumes. I have to say, I'm recommending it. It's the summer. I know the semester is about to end, so... But My Brilliant Friend is... So it's interesting for the phenomenon of what it's done in relation to suddenly changing the status of Italian works in translation in the United States, and its way of also raising and creating a kind of greater interest in reading works in translation in the U.S., which has been a major problem in the U.S. But the thing I was going to say about it is that most of its characters are speaking Neapolitan. That is to say, they're speaking Italian, one of the many dialects of Italian. But the book is written in what is the sort of national, the Tuscan, right? The national version of Italian all the way through, and there's never any representation of that dialect at all. And one of the questions that been asked is sort of, is it a problem that the book is too understandable? That is it too understandable in Italian because it's being written in a kind of literary Italian? Though, of course, there are still people living in Italy, especially in working class areas outside of the north, who don't actually understand what we call Italian and don't work and read in that language. But in any case, it's too understandable within Italy, or is it too understandable also in its translated versions, which also appear in a kind of standard version of whatever national language it goes into? But but what's sort of striking about it is that it, like a lot of other novels, is kind of wants us to think about this question of understanding and not understanding and of the kinds of aggregations that have always existed within national lexicons by refusing to sort of sample and exoticize the dialect form. And so we're constantly being told that someone is speaking in dialect. You can't get away from it. And even that some characters don't read or don't speak Italian at all, so there'll be a character who is hearing Italian that we are seeing on the page, but we're told that she has actually no access to that Italian at all. But it is, it's not functioning mimetically in the ways that it seems to me earlier work in the 20th century has functioned. It's not functioning to show us what and allowing us to sort of see what all of the different languages on the page would be, but also it's not kind of creating a limit to that knowledge, but it also doesn't allow us to imagine that there's some kind of standard language that we all understand against which the dialect would be the non-understandable thing. It seems to me what these works are trying to suggest is that the mastery we thought we had was actually leaving things out, that it was selective and relative, and that these moments of relative fluency are actually what we should begin to understand is the norm of the community in which we live in, rather than the sort of excess or the exception in some way.
I think that's the point, really. I think the point is that, you know, this kind of text asks us to rethink our thoughts of, you know, universal comprehensibility, yeah, and homogeneity and so on, and to sort of question our ideas of, you know, whether this kind of comprehensibility actually, mm-hmm, was a feature of the past as opposed to not being a feature of the present.
Yeah. Yeah.
Other questions?
Vikings, where they also try to recreate Viking speech and talking very historical.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, we've also got series like, you know, War and Peace, produced by the BBC, which is set in Russia. Most people in the period would have spoken French, but we just take it that they all have British accents and enjoy the series.
Yeah.
So I think it might be the influence of the film industry and this translating voice over and having actors from all around the world in one cast and handling all these languages that influences how literature.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very interesting to think about the exceptions to that sort of frictionless dubbing and translation that goes on. And so that has interested me. For example, the Scandinavian series, The Bridge, I don't know if that's been available here, but where some of the characters are speaking Swedish and some are speaking Danish, and it's happening at the very same time. And one of the difficulties is that if you're reading it, if you don't actually understand either Swedish or Danish, and you're just watching the American or the English language subtitles, it's in an American English, you begin to just think it's all happening in the same language. So the text functions as a kind of blockage to a kind of monolingual literary or visual production in its original, but it's hard, in the current dubbing, it's hard to actually make it work in a way. It's not dubbed, but in the subtitling, it's hard to make it work that way for those of us who are engaging with it in English or in other languages. But it seems to me that there are other kinds of resources or ways of choosing to go about that. Sometimes films purposely decide not to offer subtitles for some of the speech that's offered there. Sometimes they choose to dub in kind of analogous ways. That is to say, it won't be, let's say it's a French language film in which some people are speaking Arabic. One version would be to have an English language film in which some people are speaking Spanish, say. So that there's an effort to try to create by analogy some sense of the political relationship among the languages that existed in the first place. Of course, as with Kingsnorth's novel, you know, films don't travel very well if they have that sort of blockage to them. And mostly, you know, filmmakers, or at least the companies that produce those films, want things to travel as easily as possible. And there's that kind of tension between in the marketplace. But it seems to me that filmmakers who have done well on mass market films often have the opportunity to make a decision for themselves or to fund their own films. And I mention this because it seems to me that, you know, Katseya is a good example of a novelist who has a lot more control over how his novels are circulated and produced than most novelists do. And for that reason, he can decide that he wants the novels that he has composed in English to appear in Dutch a full month before they appear in English at all. And that he knows that if he doesn't do that, that the Dutch version won't really sell at all because people will just buy it in English. But he kind of puts it out there first in Dutch and allows that to happen, and also chooses to work with regional publishers within South Africa and Australia, even though the books could perfectly well be circulated by his UK, you know, publisher. So it seems to me that you can see these local choices being made that are an effort to kind of push back against the globalization of the industry. But of course, that pressure is there.
I would like to ask you what you think of early modern fiction, for instance, Icaro novels or reports in German, travelers, whatever, which don't mention the problem, the linguistic problem.
Yeah.
So people travel around, they're gathering, let's say, very modern armies, which were, I mean, Alzheimer's they pass borders. They get enslaved in Turkey and they come back and what they do. Or if you look at Marco Polo or other texts, so apparently they don't. I mean, apparently there's no linguistic dimension to what they experience.
Yeah.
So what would you do?
Well, actually, I think that the moment in which, just to take novels as a genre, are deeply concerned with the monolingualism of their form is actually quite brief. It's, that is to say, it seems to me partly a product of romanticism and of the kind of nationalist spirit of the early 19th century, and that it, in that moment, characters become very interested in noting what language they're speaking in and the importance of distinguishing between the one language and its relation to territory and another, the sense of wanting to establish boundaries diegetically within the story and also boundaries textually between that novel and what it represents for its nation and what language it happens to be in and who is going to be the reader, the proper reader of that novel and who won't be, that is part of the history of the novel, it seems to me. And it I don't know the period that you're describing as well as I would like to, but it seems that what you're saying would really make sense within our understanding of what happens to the novel at the beginning of the 19th century in relation to theories of national language and in relation to the understanding of what the novel's role in solidifying a kind of cultural and political sovereignty would be. And then it also makes sense to me historically that writers today who are thinking about the relation between language and culture and state differently would start to try to break away, maybe in a way that is closer to that early modern moment than to what has been the kind of modern era.
About the digital semi-automated or automated translations and their more and more apparent influence on translations. Mm-hmm. And would you say that we also should consider those kind of influences for also the book market, since it also problematizes the question of author or local or place? Would you say that this also ties into your research?
Mm-hmm. You know, thank you for that question. My friend and colleague, Jim English, teacher at the University of Pennsylvania, has just kind of pointed out that, you know, literary works are a very small percentage of all of the works that are being published every year. And it seems to me that if you can consider, if you include in works that are published all of the user's manuals that come with the new coffee pots that you buy, and all, you know, all of the other sort of functionalist things that are written in one language and move into other languages, that machine translation is probably, I would guess, or at least machine-assisted translation, is a much larger slice of the translation pie going on right now than this sort of fastidious, experimental, hands-on kind of anti-market translation that I'm describing. So I think the So that's the first thing, is just to say that machine translation, I think, is everywhere. It's just not maybe focused on literary fiction. But I do think that experimental writers, often those who are working across or between genre of poetry and fiction and visual art, are very interested in a way that I think recalls for us the sort of Dada and other early 20th century kind of experimental modernist avant-garde writers in making use of the kind of accident of Google Translate. And in fact, at the beginning of Born Translated, there's a moment where I tell people to try experimenting with Google Translate on my book, and I actually produced the line in which I tell people to do it by using Google Translate myself. And so I think that, and I occasionally use Google Translate just to get a rough idea of something. It's not, I'm okay with that, you know? So it seems to me, I'm glad that it exists, but I think that, you know, the effort now to kind of think about the relationship between translation and mistranslation, and rethink our sense of what a perfect translation is, has come to the fore, and that the artists who are kind of using Google Translate are sometimes trying to not just lament Google Translate, but to actually try to point out that some of that kind of accident and mistakenness is part of the norm of translingual conversation and interlingual conversation, and that that is worth holding on to. Thank you.
You have mentioned the Italian case, and
yeah.
Well, as a former Italian, now I'm German, but they're Italian. I want to mention the spatial situation of Italy, because I always thought that literature must be multilingual. And in the case of Italian literature, we are at the beginning, before Italy was a state, a nation, because it was 1861.
Yeah.
At that time, Italian was spoken before 1% of the population.
Yeah.
There was no Italian language. There was the, literary language that was spoken by nobody, not even the first king of Italy, was able to speak Italian or French. But the dialects were very well spoken, understood everywhere. If somebody knew only his own language, could not go maybe more than 20-30 kilometers from his town. So, if you think of the Commedia dell'arte, that was this special theater at that 17th century, it was always with at least 10, 15 different dialects, and people enjoyed to compare the difference.
Yeah.
If you think to the more modern writers, Vittorini, Pavese, Garda, in their novels,
mm-hmm.
It's a huge distribution of dialects,
mm-hmm.
many different dialects, and it's the way to give life to literature, because it's the other way around. Manzoni, the one who made the at school, it was compulsory reading, made the artificial language, and after him and against him, modern writer tried to give the back to put the dialect again.
Yeah.
And also, we must add that there are still a lot of people writing novels, poetry in the different dialect, but they are not dialect because, as linguists, they say they are all languages. So the Napolitan, there is a huge literature in all these different languages, and therefore they come into the high, let's say, literature, and in the best novels nowadays, you find always some of these references, because they had to concretize the person. If somebody is from Neapel, it must put some word of Neapolitan into the mouth.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's artificial and be rejected.
Yeah.
How far are they mutually comprehensible?
Not very easy. I am from the north of Italy, so I had to learn something to understand the Sicilian and the Calabrese. But this is not so, since we have radio, television, and also dialect. I remember when I was still living in Italy that we had a very well known writer of theater pieces.
Yeah.
It was all in the dialect of Genoa. Mm-hmm. And we learned through these pieces, this dialect. I never spoke it, but I understand still now this dialect, and also Neapolitan, and also other the dialect of Venice, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And if I speak with friends in Venice or in Turin, I use, if I speak about linguistics or philosophy or economy, I never speak Italian, I always use this language, this dialect. Because that's more immediate. It's what is still something that is as life. If somebody doesn't understand this dialect, of course I have to go back to Italy. But in that precise moment, I feel that I'm missing something that I cannot express. So sometimes we use English or German.
Yeah.
So what that means, of course, that, you know, if a reader of this text, an Italian reader of this text, reads both as a, as you said, you know, as a native reader and as a foreign reader at the same time.
And it seems to me part of the contemporary phenomenon in a lot of different literary cultures, particularly in stronger literary cultures, in which it's, you know, there's a kind of pushing back against a kind of national kind of linguistic uniformity or the national language, whereas you see in some spaces where there's still a feeling that there needs to be an assertion of what the national, that there is a national language, you actually see that hasn't happened yet, but it might happen later. So it seems to me also that, you know, you first, there's a kind of assertion that there's a definitive national language and that there should be standardization and that people writing works of literature should follow that standardization. And then once that's established, or perhaps because of a kind of literary or political kind of dissent in relation to that form of homogeneity, you get a kind of pushing back. And I think about, for example, you know, in Korea, there was a very, South Korea, a very strong standardizing, both of the alphabet and of the use of language. And in the 50s and 60s, you know, there was even a kind of resistance against using puns in literature because it was thought to introduce too much semiotic instability into a situation in which they were just getting to the point of declaring themselves as a distinctive nation with a literature at all of their own. And I came across this because I did a review of this fantastic three-volume set produced in honor of the 150th anniversary of the translation of the publication, of Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland. And in the volume, it was about the history of the translations. And there's a essay by one of the contemporary translators who compares the 1950s, 60s translation of Alice in Wonderland into Korean with the 21st century translation. And what's so interesting is that the earlier one, you would think that Alice in Wonderland was a dirge. You know, it's like it was just a accounting of the plot of Alice in Wonderland, if you could imagine something like this, of a, you know, a novel that is full of silly wordplay and so forth. None of that is there because that seemed not what was important to translate. And also they were partly translating Alice in Wonderland to show that they were an important enough culture to have a major work of Alice in Wonderland in it. But by the early 21st century, two things have happened in Korea. One is that they feel a little more powerful than they did as a country and as a nation in the world. They feel like they have a literary history or that they don't need to prove it. But also younger generations, including younger generations of translators, are pushing back against their parents' generation and against this sort of insistence that Korean language and Korean culture has to be all the same. And so suddenly now you see a translation that's full or completely taking advantage of all of the puns that are there and uses of Koreanized, other kinds of international languages can be used within a Korean text and still it can feel like life or it can feel like what it actually is like to live there, an acknowledgement of the internal multilingualism that exists. So I think that these shifts, I think, happen at different moments in different spaces, but I so much appreciate your account because I think it reminds us also that what it means to be a national writer is both different in different spaces, but different at different moments, and we can kind of see that as we track each situation.